And now, two pigeons bemoaning the fact you can stream DirecTV satellite-free.
Hey, Frank, a little birdie told me you don't need a satellite dish to get DirecTV.
What's little birdie?
Was it Jimmy the Sparrow?
It's a figure of speech. Point is, you can stream DirecTV over the internet now.
Oh, sure. Next you're going to tell me those big birds are made of metal and filled with people, right?
You mean airplanes?
Stream DirecTV without a satellite dish. Call 1-800-DIRECTV. Terms and restrictions apply.
The Phil Hayes Show.
Hello and welcome to the show. The Phil Hayes Show brought to you by The Athletic and The Square Ball. I'm Dan Moylan. And with me from The Athletic, Phil Hay.
Hello.
And from The Square Ball, Michael Normanton.
Hello.
Right now and for a limited time, you can subscribe to The Athletic for just £1 a month. It's where all Phil's fantastic storytelling on Leeds United lives, and there's loads more too from the Premier League, the football world and sport from around the globe. And I am looking forward to reading that bit on Jean-Kevin Augustin, which you'll get a flavour of actually in a short while on this show when we have a chat about that particular mystery. If you want to get involved in that, then theathletic.com/Leeds pod to sign up. Go to theathletic.com/Leeds pod and sign up for just £1 a month. International break then, Phil. A little bit of downtime, particularly with it coinciding with the end of the international transfer window. We'll come round to all that stuff in just a bit, but let's wrap up the footballing side of things and have a look, first of all, at Man City, but also the season so far. Good run at the weekend, wasn't it? Very enjoyable, I presume, from your point of view.
Very enjoyable, very watchable, very much what we were expecting from Bielsa and Guardiola. And I think outside of the spectacle itself, another step forward for Leeds, who I've just felt in the first month have adapted really well to the division and have also shown really good ability to kind of learn on their feet and to react on their feet in periods of games that have been difficult or in patches where it seemed as if the tactics weren't quite coming together or they were being heavily outplayed. And there's no doubt at all that in the first 20 minutes against City, it's the best and slickest football that they've come up against so far. It really was a case of City banging on the door and coming at them from all angles, dominating the midfield with De Bruyne and Foden. And, you know, looking in that period like they would score, which they did through Sterling, and that they would probably score again. And I do think if the game had gone 2-0 at that point, it would have been very difficult for Leeds to have clawed anything back. But the thing that stood out for me in that match, aside from Bielsa, to my mind, winning the tactical battle with Guardiola by making the change at half-time and bringing on Poveda, timing the introduction of Rodrigo nicely to just add a bit more potency at a point where Leeds were getting on top. I was really impressed with the way that Phillips and Matthias Klik went from struggling against Foden and De Bruyne and finding it hard to track them, finding them hard to follow, finding it hard to anticipate their positioning, to getting on top of them in the second half and to a large extent playing them out of the game. And it surprised me in the end that it took Guardiola so long to put Fernandinho on, because I thought they were crying out for that substitution a good 15, 20 minutes earlier because of the pressure on De Bruyne and Foden, both of whom, you know, are looking to play forward and are trying in the main to be part of a front five for City. There was very little structure to their midfield and there was no solidity in it at the point where Leeds started to dominate. So again, you just see them going through the learning curve, you see them going through the learning process. And I think it's that, you know, that cliche comes around all the time in football when you lose or you drop points or you have periods in games where you don't play well, you know, you learn from it, is what people always say. But I actually think that we're seeing that and I think it is happening. And I am really impressed, you know, not just with Phillips and Klik, but to pick them out in isolation. The way they reacted on Saturday, the way they managed to work out what was going on and to find a solution to it all, I think epitomises the first month that Leeds have had.
I thought it was nice as well how Dallas and Ayling both had a bit of a torrid time early on, but by the end of the game, they were the ones pushing forward and causing Man City problems.
Well, the difficulty with Leeds, and Jurgen Klopp touched on this on the first weekend, is that they don't drop. They don't drop off and the fitness and the stamina never goes. So even if there are periods of a game where Liverpool or City or Sheffield United or anybody else think, you know, they're on top, they're dominating, it's hard to play against, but the chances are, you know, this will fade, this won't last. You find that towards the end of a game, they are still dominant or they are still playing and attacking in the way that they always do. I mean, City had the better of the closing stages. Once Fernandinho came on, the game did swing again and they found themselves in much better positions. They looked more likely to nick the goal in the last 10 minutes. But again, a bit like Bramall Lane, I came away from Elland Road feeling that if that game had gone either way, from the 20th minute to about the 80th, I felt that it was Leeds who looked more likely to win it. And I certainly felt after Rodrigo's goal went in that if another goal was going to come in the next 10 or 15 minutes, it was going to be past Ederson rather than Melier, the other end of the pitch. So I think that, you know, it's the combination of factors. It's the understanding of the tactics, and it's the technical skill and talent that Leeds do have, combined with the fitness levels and the conditioning, which is making them extremely difficult to play against. And I think this is the sort of start they were looking for. This is the sort of start that can set them up for a comfortable year in the Premier League. And I know Bielsa would never say this, but they must be quietly delighted with how it's gone.
Do you think there's been genuine progress within those first four games?
I do. I think you've seen in games how they've managed to get a hold of them. I thought it was most evident at Sheffield United, where in the first half it was back and forward. They were a bit porous down the right on Ayling's side of the field. They got away with one with that fantastic save from Melier in the first half. But I sat through the second half there feeling as if I was watching so many of the games that I'd seen Leeds play under Bielsa in the Championship, them on the front foot and, you know, occupying that area outside the opposition box, passes back and forward, chances, just that, you know, the general feeling that they're in control. And it's the fact that you're seeing this in this division against better sides. I mean, there were lengthy stretches against Manchester City, and I put that down as the best performance so far, the City game, but there were patches in that where City were struggling to cope. You know, we're struggling to contain Leeds, we're struggling to work out the formation, we're having problems with the pace and the width. And, you know, I do feel like they've developed again. I do feel like they've improved. And also, and we've spoken about this before, you know, the ability to adapt and to improvise with longer balls when they need to, and you know, a way of getting past the press, which has been pretty pronounced from most of the teams they've played against so far. They are trying to push Bielsa's players further back, and they are trying to press high up the pitch. But they've coped, and I think they've come out with this with 7 points deservedly. You know, I think 8 would probably be right, because I think they deserved a point away at Anfield on the first weekend of the season. Any more than that would potentially have been more than they'd earned. But I mean, it's exactly what they were looking for.
That was one thing that was quite telling for me, was the speed at which Man City closed down Calvin Phillips. I think early on in that first 20 minutes, they really had our number and realised he is kind of the fulcrum of this entire system. And it was really pleasing to see Leeds figure a different way to play around that.
Yeah, I mean, you saw right from the start that Mahrez, who was playing in the middle of City's front three, so not an out-and-out number nine, he was screening Phillips. He was making it very difficult for Leeds to play the ball to him. He was almost tempting Leeds to pass the ball to Phillips in circumstances where he was liable to lose it or to find that he had Mahrez or somebody else on top of him. But I mean, if you went back and watched the game again, you would see that over time and as the game developed, Phillips started to work out the positions he could move into to get himself a bit of space, the positions he could run into to open up space for other people like Cleek alongside him. And it started to come together pretty quickly. And you felt as if by the end of the first half, even though City had, you know, the better of the chances and you know, could easily have been more than a goal up, you felt that by halftime they'd settled and they'd got into the game. They were certainly in it. And it was just that ability that Bielsa has to make a substitution at halftime, to change things, to kind of up the intensity and to put City, you know, in a place where they're a long distance from the comfort zone. And, you know, I don't think Guardiola will have enjoyed that on Saturday particularly. I think from a neutral football perspective and as somebody who loves the game, he'll have appreciated what sort of a game it was and how it looked to people watching. But I think a lot of that second half will have been very uncomfortable for him.
What do you think Rodrigo did differently when he came on?
I think he did a lot of what he did at Sheffield United, and the change of him coming on for Roberts just gave Leeds more movement in the midfield and more variation and variety in his play. And, you know, we started to see this from Rodrigo at Bramall Lane. I didn't think he'd particularly flickered in either of the first two league games or in the Carabao Cup tie against Hull City either. But at Bramall Lane, he was very good at dropping deep and dropping deep intelligently, you know, knowing when to come and when to stay and how to try and drag defenders out of position. And also very, very careful with the ball, good touch. The thing against City was he started to look like he was going to score every time he went anywhere near the ball. He had that shot off the bar. He had the header that Ederson saved brilliantly, tipped that onto the crossbar as well. And then obviously the finish that was a bit of a gimme, but it was a substitution that made City worry. You know, it made them concerned about what he was doing and where he was, and they found him incredibly difficult to pick up in the 10-15 minute period after he came off the bench. I mean, it's a surprise to me, and it was a surprise, that that Bielsa's going with Roberts ahead of him. And you know, I kind of understood it at Bramall Lane, because if anything, Roberts had been the better of the two players against Fulham, and you know, I guess the team was picked on that basis. But Rodrigo, to my mind, was so good at Bramall Lane and so effective that it seemed to make sense to start him against City. I guess on reflection, you could say that Bielsa picked the right time to get him on the pitch. And actually, once he did come onto the pitch, it felt as if Leeds were going to win the game. And in, you know, in those circumstances, you would almost have said that Bielsa had pitched it perfectly. But I think there was, I hate using this phrase, but I think there was an element of a moral victory for Leeds in that game. To play as well as they did against City and to come out of it feeling that they'd have been worth the win if they'd nicked it, I think is just another big shot in the arm.
Is that the position Rodrigo was bought to play in, do you think? Or is he being made to fit in the system at the moment?
A bit of both, I think. I mean, Leeds knew that he could play as a 10, he can play out wide, he can play up front if Bielsa wants him to, but it was inevitable that Bamford was going to start the season as number 9, and nothing Bamford's done so far has weakened his position at all. If anything, it's consolidated him, and I think Bielsa will be backing him even more rigidly than he normally does. If you look at Rodrigo's kind of recent history, the assists have been stronger from him than the goals. You know, they've been more numerous. It suggests that actually the creative side of his game has been a bit more effective than the goal scoring side. I think Leeds would hope to get both out of him, but I don't think you would say that he's been shoehorned into position, if you know what I mean. He's playing somewhere where he is comfortable and somewhere where he's good enough to operate. I suspect it's not his favourite position. I suspect he would rather play as a 9 if he could, but we're not in circumstances where you've got a central midfielder being asked to kind of masquerade as a 10. He's very, very much a forward who can play in a variety of areas.
And of course, Bielsa likes players who can do that. Roberts being one of them. Interesting to chart Roberts' progress, because if you were to go on Twitter during that first half against Manchester City, a lot of people were singling him out as the weak link, even though he did do some good stuff. And it was interesting to see like his ascendancy just before lockdown. He really started to play himself into that side, didn't he, when we were still in the Championship post-lockdown. Nice run of form. But I think with this step up, maybe are we likely to see a slightly more bit part role now for Roberts going forward?
Would definitely be my assumption. Although, you know, Bielsa takes his own view of this. And I think in the same way that there were periods last season where people were clamouring for Bamford to come out of the team and he didn't, Bielsa wouldn't drop Roberts on the basis of him getting picked apart on social media or even on the basis necessarily of a couple of fairly mediocre performances. He tends to take a broader view of things. But I think it becomes harder and harder to justify Robert's selection when you have Rodrigo playing like that. And when you have a player like Rodrigo in your squad at all, who is obviously worth the money that's been paid for him, and, you know, Spain international with a lot of experience at an elite level behind him. It's been very difficult for Robert since he signed from West Brom. Constant injury problems. And, you know, I wrote last season about the issues he'd had with the shin injury that he suffered or was diagnosed with just after he signed. You know, it had an infection in there, had to have the bone cleaned out. It's cost him a lot of time away from the team. It's cost him a lot of appearances. And you still feel, even now looking at him, that you do get good bits and pieces out of him. I thought that, you know, the pass to Dallas in the first half that created that chance that Ederson saved was very, very clever. He does have that about him. And like you say, in the weeks leading up to the lockdown, he did seem to be shining, did seem to be thriving. But I wouldn't have said that was the case in the 9 games post-lockdown particularly, and I wouldn't have said it's been the case either in the early weeks of this season. So I think, but you know, still there to be used, I think very much a squad player, but it's hard not to feel that Rodrigo really is the option that's got to be used there.
Going back to that period after lockdown when Hernandez was absolutely key to everything we did, how encouraging is it that we don't seem to need him quite as much?
Well, it's an early point to draw that conclusion really, isn't it? If I go back to the way I felt about last season, at the point where lockdown came and Leeds were on that run of wins without conceding a goal, it didn't feel that Hernandez was particularly essential in that team either. You know, he's always somebody you want on hand, and he's always somebody you would rather play than not. But Leeds were coping in the periods where they didn't have him. They were looking very strong. I you know, I've said a few times that I don't think at that point in mid-March Hernandez would necessarily have been the outright candidate for the Player of the Year award. And, you know, that to my mind seemed to be based on the kind of unbelievable streak of form that came when the game started back up. You'll get a better idea further down the line this season whether or not they can cope without Hernandez long-term. And obviously this isn't a long-term thing for him, and I would expect him to be very close, if not back, on the other side of the international break, given that he was looking at a two-week absence with this groin strain. But the bottom line is that they have to move on from Hernandez at some point, and not move on to the point where they get rid of him here and now, but they have to. And to be perfectly honest, under Bielsa, this has been the case. They have to move to a point where actually other players can carry the club in the same way. And I know Hernandez had that sensational run at the end of last season, but they haven't been anywhere near as reliant on him as they were in periods when Gary Monk was manager, or in periods when Heckenbottom and Christensen were manager as well, where it really felt at times like if you didn't have Hernandez and you didn't give the ball to him, what were you going to do? You know, what was the solution? And how were Leeds going to figure difficult situations out? It doesn't feel to me quite like that anymore, but I still don't doubt that he's an essential player that Bielsa is going to need at some stage.
Over on the Square Ball pod this week, Moscow made a good point regarding Gianni Alioski and the fact that he was taken off. And perhaps this is the first sign of a little... decline is the wrong word, but perhaps he slides down the pecking order just a little bit, particularly when we talk about Rafinha, which we'll come on to shortly, and then the overall shape of the squad. Alioski might find himself as a more kind of a sub to be brought on to disrupt things late on rather than somebody who's a starter.
Yeah, I think if truth be told, we're already at that point. We've got Dallas at left back. It would have been Jack Harrison playing on Saturday if he wasn't ineligible to play against City. It feels to me like Alioski is a bench player, although I think the fact that he's ahead of Barry Douglas, and we were reporting over the weekend that Watford and Blackburn are both interested in Douglas, and it does start to feel like he will probably go at some stage now, given that Leif Davis was preferred to him on the bench against City. But, you know, Alioski is ahead of Douglas, but it doesn't feel to me like he's going to be a regular starter this season. I think Rafinha can play on both sides, right or left. Harrison, you know, a little bit like Cleek and a few others, is somebody that Bielsa is happy to rely on any day of the week, and I think will do constantly this season. And somebody equally who just seems to get, you know, to improve as the years go by here. He was decent in season one. I thought he was excellent in season two. I can see him being very, very good again in season three with Bielsa in the Premier League. So it doesn't leave much room for Alioski when it comes to the starting lineup. And I felt it was a fairly weak performance from him on Saturday. I didn't think, given that it was such an open door to impress and play well, that he made much of an impact, although I have to say I'm not sure which left winger would have made a particularly great impact in, you know, the opening 20 minutes when City were so on top. But yeah, I think Moscow is absolutely right. I think it will be a bench role for Alioski, and you know, it was inevitable at some point, you know, that there would be players who've been key and crucial in this championship spell under Bielsa who would start to become peripheral little by little. You know, it's the way of the world and it's the way of the game, and if Leeds do establish themselves in the Premier League, then he won't be the last player that it happens to.
So far so good then. What would you rank this season out of 10 so far?
I think I'd give it a solid 8. I don't think any worse than that. If you were picking holes in what's gone on, I think you would probably say that the bits of the defending in the first two games that were uncharacteristic compared to the defences it had been under Bielsa last season in the Championship. But they've looked very structured, they've looked very organised, they look like they're as confident in their tactics in this division as they were in the division below. And I've been really, really impressed with their ability to adapt in games, you know, to adapt to what's going on the pitch, to cope as they have. And to be honest, to match up really cleverly and really quite impressively to the best that Liverpool have to offer and the best that City have to offer. I think 1 point from those two games was as little as they deserved, and I think it could quite easily have been 4.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard it right. You can talk to a real human in customer service anytime. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask me. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/creditcard.
We started to speak about Rafinha there in part one, so let's get into that one in a little bit more detail now then. Final signing of the international window, which closed earlier this week. And talk us through this signing from your point of view then, Phil. Good, bad, indifferent?
Another good one. I mean, we'll come on to the transfer window as a whole a little later, but I think it's been a very good summer for Leeds. I've been, you know, they feel like they've had it in control right from the start. They feel as if they've, or it certainly feels to me, that they've been in a position where even if certain deals have run into trouble or if they've had complications that they weren't necessarily expecting, they've had fallbacks, they've had secondary plans, they've had things that were in the background ready to go if they needed them. And you know, Rafinha was a very late one. He's somebody who, from what I'm told, was a player that both Bielsa and Orta had been tracking independently of each other. The way it tends to work at Leeds is that Orta will do his scouting for positions. He'll come up with options, which he'll put to Bielsa. Bielsa equally will have, you know, in his head or on paper lists of players who he likes and lists of players that he's looking at. And in this case with Rafinha, it married up. You know, Orta liked him, Bielsa liked him, and he was somebody that they wanted to do. But he was also somebody who they assumed wouldn't be available and wouldn't be on the market. Rennes qualified for the Champions League for the first time last season. They paid best part of $20 million to take him from Sporting in Lisbon 12 months earlier. So he hadn't been on the scene in France for very long, and he was a player that they rated. But Rafinha wanted to go, and in the end made it clear to Ren that he did want to go. And I saw the reports, like everybody else, on Monday saying that he'd been forced out against his will and he'd been made to leave even though he wanted to stay at Rafinha. But my understanding is that that's not correct. He was as keen to make the move as anybody else was. And so it was a very late one for Leeds, one that they had to get done pretty quickly Saturday, Sunday. And then obviously pushed through quickly on Monday, and in the end it wasn't particularly quick, it was 10:30 when it was announced, but to push through before the 11 o'clock deadline. And it's another deal that they're really, really happy with. And again, you're talking about somebody who's played at a high level of a very strong European league, somebody who has all the attributes you look for in a winger. He's two-footed, he can play on either side, he's quick and he's creative and has the odd goal in him as well. And, you know, I agree with the people who feel that it would have been nice to have had a central midfielder, an 8 or a 10, in through the door as well, just to consolidate that position. But I think Rafinha rounds off what has been a very, very tidy window.
Some of the details on the Rafinha deal. Rennes actually made a slight loss on the fee, didn't they? Because if they'd have gone over a certain mark, presumably they had a deal in place with Sporting where if they received more than they paid for him 12 months previously, they would have had to pay a big wedge of it onto Sporting. So they've actually, we've paid less than they paid for him a year ago, with obviously add-ons taking that fee north of the basic fee. But still, we've got a pretty good deal by the looks of it.
I think Leeds were surprised by the fee, although I was reading some quotes from the president over at Rennes today, in which he was saying that, you know, given the add-ons and the bonuses that are due and everything else, he thinks that they'll end up in profit on this one. He doesn't seem too concerned about that. But again, yeah, it was good value, and it fell into the budget that Leeds could afford. They've committed a lot of money to this window, and clearly, you know, as recently as last Thursday, they were talking about spending £20 million on Michael Cuisance as well from Bayern Munich, which fell through because of the medical. But it just looks to me like a quality signing. And I think what's happened this summer is that they've got to a point where they've enhanced the dressing room significantly, and they've enhanced it with quality signings. But they haven't torn away the core of what Bielsa's done in the Championship. They haven't gutted his squad, and they haven't butchered what was left over after the title win last season. You've still got essentially the basis of the same team with the same ethos and the same tactics. But I do feel that the players that have been added, without exception, are improvements on what was already there.
Was Rafinha made possible because we didn't do Cuisance, so was the potential there for both of them to arrive?
I think it would have been a push to do both, but the reality with Rafinha was that he came up as an option in the last couple of days. There wasn't something, even at the beginning of the week where they were going after Cuisance, that Leeds expected to be an option. I mean, obviously, we have the domestic window open now for, you know, another week or so, and football being football, the market never seems to truly close. But my understanding is that if they do anything in this window, and if they do manage to find themselves a centre mid who's agreeable and that they want to take on, then it's likely to be done on loan with a future obligation or option as opposed to cash up front at the moment because they have spent an awful lot of money. So, yeah, I don't know really. If they'd done Cuisance, I don't know if the funding would have been there to have done Rafinha. I don't know if they'd got Cuisance, whether they might have decided that actually they already have a fair amount of in the way of options out wide, which they do. I mean, especially looking at the way Poveda played on Saturday against City, suddenly he's come into the frame as someone who looks like he might be up to playing games in the Premier League this season, which obviously begs the question, and in the same way as Diego Llorente and as Rodrigo's found for a few weeks as well, of how quickly Rafinha is going to be able to get into the team. I think in a lot of circumstances, a manager would sign somebody like him and think, right, he plays from the off. But Bielsa isn't really like that. And there's a pecking order for everybody, regardless of how much the club have paid for them. So, you know, he's going to potentially have to bide his time a little bit and wait for a goal. And I do, you know, I do wonder if Cuisance had come in, whether Leeds would have felt that ultimately they just about had enough anyway. But either way, I think they've covered themselves nicely.
The window as a whole, then, it's been pretty good. And as Angus Kinnear mentioned to us when we spoke to him on the Square Ball podcast, way back when, a thing we've referenced a couple of times in recent weeks, they were looking at about 75 to 100 mil, and they've done that comfortably.
Yeah, they have. And that's before you factor in the academy signings on top of that. You know, it's been an expensive summer, just looking at the kind of top line figure of what's been committed. But I think it was going to have to be like that. You know, even if, you know, the way we saw it at the start of the window, that there might be a pretty strong focus on the Championship. I think even if they had been drawn into Ollie Watkins, Benrahma and so on, you'd have been talking about very, very sizable fees. And given that they were going for four or five players tops, that it wasn't going to be a complete change to the dressing room. It was important that they committed a lot of cash to quality signings as opposed to signing at a lower level. There was no real need to go for lower level signings because they didn't need to spread the budget particularly. You know, they had the cash to do 3, 4, 5 at a high level. So it has been a significant outlay, but I do think it's the right way to go as well. I think it was important when it came to settling in the Premier League and gaining a foothold that they did push the squad on and they did enhance it. And it, you know, there is always that temptation when you come up to stick as closely as you can to the squad you've got because you don't want to create disharmony and you don't want to unsettle it. I mean, I always think that there's a middle ground to be found between not changing it to the extent where it's unrecognisable and you know, all the work and the understanding that's been created disappears, but equally not leaving it in a position where it doesn't change. And to be blunt, where existing players don't feel any pressure to improve, I think there are a lot of areas in the team now where the need to be better than they were in the Championship is quite apparent because of who else is there and who else wants to play.
And they do quite a bit of due diligence on the characters of the players as well as their technical abilities, don't they? They don't want characters who are going to come in and be disruptive. And we spoke about the fees there. We'll get into the sort of the how they did that in part three. But let's just have a quick run through the players that they have signed. Michael, Ben White or Cock and Llorente, which do you think?
Everyone's forgotten about Ben White, haven't they? I think that's how well Cock has done in the last couple of games. People have seen the quality he's got and they've maybe seen clips of Ben White not looking so good. So I think you've got to take two players. And I know Bielsa's not been as bothered by it, but I've been absolutely desperate for a spare centre-back for 2 years now. So to have that luxury feels worth having.
Yeah, I'd go along with that. I think particularly because of the age of Cock and the fact that, you know, he's at a similar stage of his career as White, looks to me to be a very similar player. And I think, if you're being fair, probably has the potential to be better. I don't think it's in any way certain that White will emerge as the better centre-back 3 or 4 years down the line. And again, I'm with Michael. Cover at centre-back has felt necessary for me for a while, and Bielsa has coped without it because Bielsa has this marvellous knack of being able to. But I don't think in this division, having Llorente on the bench is a bad thing at all.
In terms of outgoings then, you mentioned Douglas before. It feels like his time at Leeds is up now, given that he's finding himself way down the pecking order. But Bielsa said he's got the opportunity to be involved later on in the season, but it doesn't feel like he's going to be, does it?
Well, the slight difference here between, say, Janssen or Saez and certain others, Augustine as well, is that there's no effort on Bielsa's part to force him out. I don't know how Douglas sees it exactly, but you know, Douglas might feel that the fact that he's not involved is a kind of hint as to where he is in the pecking order. But you tend to find with Bielsa that when he decides that somebody's surplus and needs to go, they go. I mean, I always think back to the Sai's departure, the fact that Sai said to the club, look, I'm homesick, I want to go back to Spain in the next January window. And this was kind of early to mid-December. And Bielsa said, well, in that case, he can go tomorrow. You know, I don't care about waiting until the window opens, and I don't care about having him here for the, four, five, six games in between. If he's gone, then he's gone. And Sayers was. It hasn't been like that with Douglas. And I think there is a lot of appreciation of Douglas's input in the dressing room. I think he's a popular guy at Thorpe Arch, a player who a lot of people like, but he isn't playing. And, on Saturday, to see Leif Davis on the bench ahead of him, kind of said to me that this is coming to an end and will come to an end. I think the options at Watford and Blackburn, I think Watford are keener at this stage and have made more effort to kind of explore this deal and see what they can do. I think if they become serious, and if they're there to be had, given that Douglas is up in a year's time, or less than, up next June and out of contract, it would surprise me a little if he said no to that.
Just returning to the closing of the transfer window, we did have hints of a potential midfielder coming in. And was that likely to happen ever on the evening, Phil? And you mentioned they might look at one now domestically, and it'll probably be something around a loan to buy. It just feels a little bit nebulous at the minute. Can you flesh that out a bit?
Yeah, no, it is. I mean, as far as they were concerned, as of last week and as of, Thursday lunchtime, they were going to do cuisance, and clearly the medical threw-up issues that they weren't prepared to gamble on. And from that point onwards, it wasn't that they weren't looking, and it wasn't that there weren't potentially options out there, but it never got to the stage, certainly on Friday, where you felt as if somebody was coming through the door. They had a lot of work to do with Rafinha. I think they wanted to make sure that one got done. And the other aspect with Bielsa is that you're not just looking for a central midfielder you're not just looking for a 10 or an 8. You're looking for somebody who is in those positions, but also fits in with his specification and the list of requirements when it comes to attributes and talent. So, the same is going to apply to the EFL window. If something came up in there that they thought was worth doing and that Bielsa thought he could work with, then they will probably go for it, and particularly, as I say, if they can do it as a loan. But to be quite honest, if they can't, then they won't. And I think that was the feeling after Cuisance, was that they weren't desperate for a player in that position. They could do with one, and they could, it would be useful to have more options there, and particularly because at the moment it's still not clear when it is that Adam Forshaw is going to be available or even particularly close to returning to the squad. Last time we asked Bielsa about him, he said that Forshaw is probably going to need 4 or 5 under-23s games before he's considered. So, you'd be looking at the thick end of a month to 2 months before that happens. So, that is the one thing that's on their mind with the domestic window left. But, just so people are aware of what the stipulations are, Premier League clubs can't deal with each other now. They can only trade with EFL clubs and can't trade with anybody abroad either. So it does very much narrow down the pool of what's to choose from and the pool of clubs that you can speak to.
Do you think there's any likelihood they'd revisit Benrahma, and what of Todd Cantwell now?
They've been cold on Cantwell since the rumours came to light on the Sunday of the Sheffield United game. My understanding is that it's been Cantwell's camp and his agent who've been pushing this as much as Leeds have. I think that's where a lot of the information's coming from. It's not to say, again, that they don't like Cantwell or they don't see ability in him, but it hasn't felt as if, in the way that they were getting on with Cuisance and in the way that they were getting on with Rafinha, and I know they've got longer to think about Cantwell, but it hasn't felt as if that one was really tugging at them, certainly not towards the back end of the international window. Benrahma was on the list right at the start, but they seemed to go off him during the summer, and it was mentioned to me by a couple of people that they hadn't been overly thrilled with the video of Benrahma on social media of him playing volleyball in his swimming pool at this huge villa. I think the question arose of what his temperament was going to be like, how well he'd fit into the dressing room, the sort of thing that the clubs do think about. And, you have to say with Benrahma, it's not only Leeds who haven't bothered there. Nobody has done anything with him. And I still find it hard to imagine that before the end of the domestic window, nobody will. But again, a little bit like Cantwell, who's desperate to get back to the Premier League, they're a little bit out on a limb at the moment, and there doesn't seem to be an awful lot moving around them. So we'll see what happens and see what changes. But I think the one thing you won't see is Leeds spending for the sake of spending and spending just so that at the end of the window they can say they've got a centre mid in. I think if it can be done and they can't find the sort of player they're after, then they would rather just leave it.
Where does Jamie Shackleton fit into all of this? Because it feels like we're into his third season now where he could potentially break into the first team and cement a place there, but it's just not quite happening for him.
Yeah, and he's a little bit far back from the first team picture, or certainly the picture when it comes to the starting lineup. And it feels that he's probably looking again at a season like the previous two, where he'll get a little chance here and there, but will probably mostly be used as a substitute from time to time, if that. He, interestingly, hasn't been mentioned over the summer as somebody who might go on loan. You know, there was a lot of talk of Matthias Bogis going out, and he went to Logroñés on deadline day. There's been a lot of talk about Robbie Gotz, and he's got plenty of interest in him. Sunderland are keen, Hull, Huddersfield, bit of talk of Swindon as well. And you've seen John Stevens go out to Swindon. You know, Bielsa has been far more open to the idea of 23s moving on temporarily to get games, but it still is the case that he wants the best of them round about, and the best of them playing in the under-23s and available for the first team squad. So Shackleton, it doesn't feel at this stage like he's necessarily going to be involved to any vast degree, but I still feel as if he is on the fringes with Bielsa in the way that he has been for the last couple of seasons.
With regards to central midfielders and the squad as a whole, I've kind of learned in this window in particular that it's better to wait to see what Leeds do, and they've got very particular players in mind, and it's okay to be patient. And if we don't quite get them, that we don't need to be that anxious. It always felt in the Championship, like, because all the stakes were always so high that we had to get everything right every single window, because otherwise the whole house of cards falls apart. But now we're up there, I feel fine about not getting an 8 or a 10, a central midfielder, because we know we can get through it one way or another. And I wonder, do you feel the same way about that, Michael? Have you got any anxiety about missing out on a midfielder?
Not really. I think the start of the season that we've had has helped massively. If we were sat looking at the table on 3 points or maybe even less, I would be probably screaming a bit more about needing some more players in. But as it is, everyone's looked like they can mull and cut it at this level, and maybe if Bielsa doesn't, but I actually do have faith that people like Jamie Shackleton will come in and do an all right job. We've seen Dallas move into midfield and do well there, so I'm not terrified. And I think if there's strength elsewhere on the pitch, you can carry a little bit of weakness elsewhere.
You're right about how it's changed. I was thinking that in a kind of competitive sense during the City game in the second half, where it was on the edge, and you're thinking Leeds could quite easily win this, but then City, being who they are, you know, could nick it towards the end of the game as well. And it's probably the first time I can remember in this job anyway, being at a game where you felt, you know, if Leeds do win this, great story, and it'll be, people will be chuffed to bits. If City win it, you might actually come out of the other side and say, okay, well, they pinched the goal late on, they got the win. But, you know, be able to focus and concentrate on the game itself and the performance, and to come away still feeling very satisfied. Whereas, you know, for as long as any of us can remember, it was impossible to ever feel like that when you were at home to Charlton or at home to Forest or at home to the multitude of Championship teams who you wanted to beat and had to be beaten if you were going to be in the mix in the way that Leeds constantly wanted to be and then, you know, were able to be under Bielsa. It is a change of dynamic, and I think you're right. You know, there is plenty at stake this season, because they cannot afford to get relegated, and they absolutely cannot afford to get relegated having invested in the way that they have. Although, like you said, we will come on to how it's been done and how the summer's been managed financially. But, you know, the sort of sense of jeopardy beyond that is much smaller. If you do find yourself in mid-table, and if you do find that by the turn of the year you're pretty comfortable, I guess if you want to put your head in the clouds, you can think about European qualification or whatever else. But, you know, there are a lot of teams in the Premier League who, from Christmas or the end of January onwards, find themselves rolling quite comfortably because they know they're going to stay up. And it takes a bit of getting used to that. But it's not a bad thing for everybody, I don't think, to take out the game-to-game stress of the league table and, you know, the promotion chase and all of those things that have been in the background and in the ether at Leeds for so long. It is a completely different season, this one.
This episode is brought to you by Michelob Ultra, the official beer sponsor of the NBA. Want to get closer to the game than ever before? Michelob Ultra Courtside is giving fans the chance to win exclusive NBA prizes and experiences like official gear, courtside seats to an NBA game, and more. Head over to MichelobUltra.com/courtside to learn more.
Looking for an assist with your credit card but can't get a hold of anyone? Luckily, with 24/7 US-based live customer service from Discover, everyone has the option to talk to a real person anytime, day or night. Yep, you heard that right. You can talk to a real human in customer service at any time. Sounds like a real game changer if you ask us. Make the right call and get the service you deserve with Discover. Limitations apply. See terms at discover.com/credit card.
We've dealt with the incomings and the expenditure there on the transfers, but how has this happened? Because there's that lingering fear at Leeds that we'll be doing what Ridsdale did and bankrupting everything and goldfish and mortgages and loans and stuff. So we've spent a lot of money. Obviously, it doesn't all go out in one go, but when you factor in agents' fees, signing on fees, so on and so forth, hefty outgoings this summer. So how have they done it?
I was saying in the piece I wrote on Monday when the deadline closed, that one of the interviews I did with Victor Otto, we were chatting about transfers and, you know, the way in which recruitment can look very straightforward or easy from the outside. And whether it works or not, it's very easy to pick holes in. And he kind of said, you know, people think it's like Football Manager, and I play Football Manager too, but, you know, the reality is very different. This has kind of felt like a window in which they almost were playing Football Manager. You know, players coming in for 27 million, 18 million, 17 million, you know, repeatedly either breaking or matching or going close to that Rio Ferdinand transfer record. And I was saying that, you know, the thing about Ridsdale was that the way he played the transfer market, it was like he was playing Football Manager, in that as soon as you ran out of money, and it all went wrong, you kind of reset the computer and started a new game. It's different this time around. It's different for a few reasons. The first being that back when Ridsdale was spending the amount of money that he was, Premier League clubs had nothing like the level of income that they do now. They were rich and they were wealthy in comparison to a lot of leagues in Europe and the leagues below them as well. But everybody knows the way in which television revenue in particular has morphed and grown over the years. So they do now have a very hefty income at Elm Road. The basic figure, and this doesn't just apply to the four new signings, you've also got the £50 million that's been committed to Helder Costa and sort of £5 million or thereabouts that's been spent on Ilham Melier coming in from Lorient in France. You're pretty close to £100 million when it comes to the kind of agreed fees and the amount, the baseline figure that Leeds have committed to. I think the important thing to say first is that in these circumstances, you never, ever pay all of this money or anything like it up front. So if it's in your head that Leeds have spent £100 million in this window, they absolutely haven't. The way I understand it is that a lot of the deals, both the fees and the wages, but the fees in particular, have been back-ended, which is to say that Leeds will pay more by way of instalment towards the end of the player's contract. And they've also done what's called amortisation. A lot of people will know what that means, but for anyone who doesn't, it's the way in which you structure a fee so that you pay it in instalments over the course of a contract. So, for example, Helder Costa, £50 million from Wolves, that will be paid in chunks over the 4 years of his deal that he signed at Elland Road. And I think it's, from what I'm told, with the individual transfers that have been made and the signings that have come in, the initial payment for them in each case has been no more than around about £3 million. So, with obviously more to come, it's, you know, not to pretend that the fees aren't there to be paid further down the line. But there are a number of ways in which this can be managed and ways in which it can be handled. And that is certainly the first one for clubs these days, is to make sure that, with very, very rare exceptions, the fees that you're agreeing to do not come out in one big whack.
Contrast that with Ridsdale, and we did a bit of a dive into this on the Square Ball podcast. And for anybody who's not aware of what he did, he borrowed against future transfer values with players like Mark Viduka, and then the transfer market obviously collapsed, and we found ourselves with players on massive wages who we couldn't shift, because if we sold them, we would actually owe money on them. We wouldn't get any of the money for the sales. It would all be owed to the finance company plus some more on top. So it would have cost us money to get rid of these players, which is why we ended up stuck with so many expensive ones at the time. And this sounds like a far more sensible approach. One thing I am curious to get your opinion on, or see if you can shed some light on it, Phil, anyway, is this factoring that we mentioned, I think, on this show a couple of weeks ago. Radrizzani did the interview with the Financial Times in the UK, where he said they may look to borrow on future TV revenues. Now, should say for the record, TV revenues last season were, Norwich got about 96 million, all the way up to like 176 million for Liverpool at the very top of the tree. And it's based on TV appearances and where you finish in the league. So let's assume we finish somewhere in the middle, hopefully. We're looking at about 130 million quid in merit and TV payments this year. And that's before you get commercial stuff that the club brings in itself as well. So we're in a healthy position.
Yeah, from what I understand, Leeds have taken a forward funding deal, which is essentially borrowings that are paid back using future broadcast income and TV rights money that is owed to you. And I believe they've borrowed in excess of £30 million, something like that, a bit over that amount. The thing to say with this is that forward funding is incredibly common in the Premier League. Most teams do it. And the way it's structured is that when it comes to repaying these loans, which come from banks or other kind of established lenders, the Premier League secure it by essentially agreeing with the lenders that they will pay the TV money direct to them when the payments are due. So in the case of Leeds or anybody else who has a forward funding deal, rather than the TV money going from the Premier League to the club and the club then having the duty or the responsibility to pay the lender back, the Premier League will pay the money direct to make sure that the loan is serviced and to make sure that the loan is no issue and that there's no breach of the terms and that it is met on the dates when it's supposed to be. So I know that the idea of borrowing in football always concerns people, but it is a very common thing. This, there will be some clubs in the Premier League, the biggest clubs potentially, you know, like Manchester City, Chelsea, with the funding they have, who don't necessarily need to do this. But it's very much common practice. And as I say, it's so much so, and it's accepted at that level to the extent where the Premier League do oversee it and make sure that the integrity of it all is looked after. Now, the one thing obviously that might do is it might mean that in future transfer windows or further down the line, there's a little less cash when it comes to further investment in the transfer market or whatever else. But I think what Leeds wanted to make sure that they did in this window was recruit in a way that created a squad that was going to be durable and sustainable for a number of seasons, so that if they recruited heavily now and you know, recruited heavily in terms of finance rather than numbers, but they would put players and signings in place who were going to benefit them for a while. And I certainly think they've done that. And I get the impression that they would like to think that going forward into January or potentially next summer, while they might need the odd player in the odd position, they wouldn't necessarily need to go the whole hog in the way that they have by committing £100 million this time round. And alongside that, you have to remember that there's been a massive upturn in commercial income at Leeds. I mean, absolutely huge in comparison to what they had in the Championship. For example, the shirt deal that they had with 32 Red was worth about £750,000 a year. SBO top on the front of the shirt now is worth about £6 million. And in total, the kit deals that they've got with Clipper and SBO top and all of these things are worth around about £10 million a year to them. They also get £1 million on top of broadcast revenue, an extra £1 million for every game they're involved in that's televised live. And so far, they've been chosen for five. Every position you finish higher in the Premier League is worth £2 million to you. And they will get a huge amount of income from shirt sales as well, which, as I'm told, they expect to shift around about 250,000 of the new Adidas kits this season, which is a massive figure and is clearly very, very lucrative. And on top of that, there is the potential for further equity investment from Radrizzani or from the 49ers or a third party. And Radrizzani's never really made much of a secret of the fact that he would be open to further minority investment. So I think the thing to say is that although to look at it in plain sight, it looks like £100 million has been spent, £100 million hasn't been spent. And I think more to the point, the club seem very, very comfortable with what they've done and very comfortable with the way in which it's been, you know, this window's been structured and the way in which the deals have been set up. And I think their feeling was that the most prudent way to act was to get players in who were going to make them stronger and who were going to make the team more competitive and more able to stay in the division. And I think as a first window, I very much see the logic in that.
Going back to the Championship days, Radrizzani was sticking in about £1 million of his own money each month to pay the bills, essentially. Is that now completely stopped, as far as you're aware?
I don't know how it's going to work over the course of the season, because quite clearly the first tranche of central revenue from the Premier League broadcast income and everything else will have been spent. And there's no question about that between the outlay on transfers, but also bonuses and so on that will have been due as a result of promotion through players' contracts and pay rises and everything else. I wouldn't be surprised if you see the wage bill virtually double as it was always liable to do. It might be that he still has to put in money, but I think the difference they have now, and you know, particularly if they're able to stay in the Premier League long term, is that season upon season, the income levels, the turnover that they'll have are just on a completely different scale. So there may not be the same pressure on him to fund in the same way. But given that obviously they've had the impact of COVID and have lost a huge amount of corporate revenue, other areas of commercial revenue have been hit as well. They have no crowd, so there's no match day income. There are shortages and there are shortfalls, so it may well be that he still has to pick some of that up. But they, you know, when I speak to them, I get the feeling that financially they feel like they're in a good place.
Angus told us that we should expect some sort of investment over the next 12 months, be it internally from Radrizzani or a third party externally. And I wonder, did you catch that extended interview? I think it was NBC who did it, but with Parag Marate, who's on the 49ers board, who's the guy who sits on the board at Elland Road as well. And that was quite informative in that he was saying there is a keenness on the part of the 49ers to be more involved, but at the minute, they're essentially passengers on Leeds United's plane.
Yeah, I think that's right. When they got involved, there was a lot of talk about the way in which the two club and the franchise could collaborate when it came to ticketing methods and perhaps medical methods and everything else. But the 49ers have very little in the way of involvement in the day-to-day running of the club. Leeds have a senior management team. They have Radrizzani as chairman, and then they have Angus Kinnear as CEO and Victor Orta as director of football. You know, most of the decisions day-to-day are taken on the ground, but they do have this shareholding, this interest of over 10% in the club. And I think they would like to increase their shareholding. I think actually Radrizzani would potentially like to see them increase their shareholding as well and commit some more money to the club. But again, it feels like a stable partnership there. It feels like a steady form of ownership, which is kind of free of too much in the way of politics and free of any real infighting. And I mean, for the money that the 49ers put in a couple of years ago for the small stake that they bought, they must be absolutely delighted with where the club are, because they've essentially invested in what everybody felt was the one club in England that could become so much bigger than they already were. And a couple of years down the line, here they are in the Premier League.
When it comes to finances, then, one of the elephants in the room has been Jean-Kevin Augustin. And it's going to be interesting to see where this one goes. And one of the stories, one of the subtexts of the transfer window closing was that he's now got himself a new club, and it's not us. It's not Red Bull Leipzig. It's a third party. It's Nantes in France. And he's apparently gone there as a free agent. And this doesn't mean, though, a de-escalation of the legal battle between Leeds and Leipzig.
No, not at all. Quite the opposite. It took a little while to unravel what had gone on Monday when it was announced that he was going to Nantes, but more to the point, he was going as a free agent. And you were in this bizarre situation where at the, you know, the tail end of the window, he was essentially nobody's player. Leipzig didn't want him and said, you know, as far as they were concerned, from the point where Leeds United were promoted, Augustin was a Leeds player. Leeds were saying he was nothing to do with them, and as far as they were concerned, he wasn't signing for them. They wouldn't be taking him on. They wouldn't be paying any money for him. And then, you know, despite the fact that there was this obligation on Leeds' part to take him, and that his contract at Leipzig ran to 2022, you had Nantes signing him for nothing and effectively announcing a free transfer, which really did require a bit more explanation. I'm still waiting for FIFA to come back to me on this to clarify exactly what's happened and exactly where we're at. But from what we're told, they've essentially sanctioned this move, and you know, the paperwork has been processed by Nantes, it's been approved by FIFA, I gather, because effectively he was going to be left without a club. You know, he's been training in France, training in Paris and gyms and parks alone through the summer. You know, since leaving Leeds at the end of his loan, he hasn't trained with them, he hasn't trained with Leipzig. He has essentially been estranged. And in this situation where he was kind of unable to play because nobody wanted him. So FIFA have approved this and he's gone to Nantes and he'll be there for 2 years. He's got a 2-year contract with them. But in the background, you have this battle. And, you know, I think we'll need to go into the details for people about what this involves, what it centres around and how it's likely to be resolved. But you've got this battle where Leipzig want £80 million for him and think they're owed it. Leeds don't want to pay £18 million for him and don't think they have to. And the only way that this is going to be sorted, given that neither side seems willing to compromise or to back down, is through some form of arbitration or legal ruling, which at this stage looks likely to come from FIFA at Leipzig's request.
But if FIFA are ruling on this, and we know that FIFA's not necessarily the most joined up organisation in its thinking, but if they've sanctioned him moving as a free agent, doesn't that have an impact on the case? Because he doesn't look like he's our player, does it?
No, I don't think it does have an impact on the case. I think they've tried to do the right thing by Augustine, in as much as they're saying, if this was to drag on this dispute for another year, in the meantime, he is left with nothing. You know, I can't tell you who's been paying him, if anybody, for the past couple of months. I genuinely don't know that. I've tried to speak to his agent, but his agent hasn't responded to any requests for comment. And you're potentially looking at somebody losing a period of their career due to the fact that two clubs who, you know, and through no fault of his own, in a contractual sense. I mean, there were obviously issues with his fitness at Leeds, and there were questions over his attitude and everything else. And when it came to it, Bielsa didn't want to keep him. But from a contractual point of view, this is not Augustine's fault. You know, this was negotiated in the last January window that he would come to Leeds permanently if they were promoted. This is all going to come down to the details of the contract, and specifically the clause in it stating that if Leeds went up, they would sign Augustine on a permanent basis. The clause was dated, and essentially Leeds had to take him if they were promoted before his loan expired, and his loan expired at the end of June, June the 30th. Because of the COVID shutdown, in the end, they were promoted in mid-July, so almost 3 weeks later. And what Leeds are arguing is that, in essence, the clause doesn't apply anymore. It expired at the point where they were promoted to the Premier League, and therefore, you know, from a legal point of view, they're under no obligation to pay the money for him. What Leipzig are countering that argument with is the claim that, in good faith, that clause should be taken to mean the end of the season, because essentially that was what was meant by the clause, and that was what was intended. It was just that at the point where Augustine's loan was agreed, nobody envisaged that COVID was coming, and nobody envisaged that the season would finish any later than the end of May, as it normally does. The problem for FIFA is that at no stage in the summer did they issue a directive or an order that clubs were required to honour any contract clause of that nature. And I think the reason they didn't was because essentially it was unenforceable. You know, legally, they could not force a club who had an obligation that ran out on July the 30th to either extend it or to activate it at a later date. I'm told that Leipzig did ask Leeds if they would alter the contract to reflect the later finish, and Leeds said no because they didn't want to do that. But essentially, Leeds feel that when it comes to the discussion and the decision about how this should play out, that they'll have the stronger case and they'll be in the right, because the contract does state quite clearly that they should have gone up. They would have signed him had they gone up by June the 30th. That didn't happen. And whether or not you think that is an attitude that's in good faith or not, from a legal perspective, it does seem like a pretty strong standpoint.
Is the potential there that FIFA could side with Leipzig, and even though we may not be forced to pay the fee, there could be other sanctions in terms of transfer bans or anything like that?
There could be sanctions. I don't know realistically whether a transfer ban is likely. I think what would be most likely to come out of this in Leipzig's favour, if they were to win the argument or win the case, is a compensation payment to them. I think that's what all sides are. I think that's what Leipzig would expect. I think that's what Leeds would expect as well, if they were to lose the case. But there is another recent example, which I suspect they'll use to try and strengthen their own argument, which is Jack Harrison from Manchester City. Leeds had an option on Harrison to sign him in the summer just gone, which also expired in the way that Augustine's did. It was due to be done before the end of June and would have cost Leeds around about £8 million. They have since renegotiated it with City, as they had to, but because of the delay and because it will now be activated next summer rather than this, they're liable to pay £2 or £3 million more for him, which is not a significant amount. But at the same time, you know, it is money that would otherwise have been theirs. So I think they feel like they've kind of fallen foul to a smaller extent from the COVID delay and the fact that contracts which look watertight or in normal circumstances would have been in dispute, you know, impossible to dispute, actually have been thrown up in the air by the fact that the season did finish so much later. But at the moment, in the absence of any comment from FIFA or any real direction from them, and at this stage, it's still to reach the point where the governing body are ready to make a proper decision on this. So how it's going to play out, I honestly don't know, but it's become very complex and actually, you know, from a legal point of view, very interesting as well.
It is interesting in the sense that any players who were out of contract, such as Berardi, had to agree to stay on beyond June the 30th due to the lockdown, which suggests maybe there's a case there to say that everybody understood that contracts expired at the end of June. And it is also interesting. I use the word interesting because I don't want to kind of overcommit on it, but it's interesting that Leipzig tried to renegotiate it, which possibly suggests that they were aware that the existing contract didn't commit Leeds to buying Augustin in the first place. So it will be genuinely interesting to see how this plays out. Phil, do you reckon there's a, and I'm being a bit cheeky now, do you think there's almost a sense of Leeds kicking the can further down the road with this one?
I'm not sure, really. I think they genuinely don't want to pay the money. You know, I think they genuinely feel that it's a transfer they would rather get out of. I think what can't be denied is that the intention was there to sign him, and I can understand Leipzig's frustration with this because they must feel that they must feel hard done to on the basis that this kind of unforeseen delay is costing them what is a very big fee for a player they didn't want and a player who is now gone for nothing and who, if they lose this case, they're going to get nothing for. I mean, I sort of said in a piece I've written about it this week, somebody's going to pay for Augustin's signature, but it most certainly isn't going to be none. You know, it's either going to be Leipzig by virtue of the fact that they are told that they're getting nothing for him, or it's going to be Leeds by virtue of the fact that FIFA tell them to, or somebody else like the Court of Arbitration for Sport tells them to pay money for him. They know it's very much in the background, but now it is in the hands of FIFA, or very much heading that way. This will be dictated by the speed at which FIFA's kind of legal department move. So no, I mean the club kind of said quite openly at the beginning of the window that Augustin wasn't going to make any difference to the budget. You know, they wouldn't be constrained in what they could spend by the fact that there was this, you know, this elephant lurking in the room and this potential liability a little bit further down the line. But I think rather than trying to just delay and delay, I do get the sense that they feel they've got a strong case and that they'll fight to avoid this.
Good stuff. Thanks for that. If you want to read about that particular elephant, Jean-Kevin Augustin, and the transfer funds and all that background stuff, subscribe to The Athletic right now for £1 a month for a limited time. All Phil's stuff is on there. theathletic.com/leadspod. Just a quid a month at the moment. Thanks for that, gents. We'll speak to you next week.
The Phil Hay Show.
As you've probably heard by now, we've teamed up with BetMGM this season. We'll be using BetMGM lines to make all of our picks, and we'll have special offers for our listeners each week. If you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC, and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager with BetMGM. Here's how it works. Download the BetMGM app and sign up using bonus code THEATHLETIC. Make your first deposit of at least $10. Place your first bet on any game and claim your voucher for a one-year subscription to The Athletic. See BetMGM.com for terms. U.S. promotional offers not available in D.C., Mississippi, New York, Nevada, Ontario, or Puerto Rico. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER. Available in the U.S. Call 877-8-HOPE-NY or text HOPE-NY 467-369 in New York. Call 1-800-NEXT-STEP in Arizona. 1-800-327-5050 in Massachusetts. 1-800-BETS-OFF in Iowa. 1-800-270-7117 for confidential help in Michigan. 1-800-981-0023 in Puerto Rico. First bet offer for new customers only in partnership with Kansas Crossing Casino and Hotel. Don't forget, if you haven't signed up for BetMGM yet, use bonus code THEATHLETIC and you'll get a one-year subscription to The Athletic, plus up to a $1,500 first bet offer on your first wager.